They stayed on in the encampment beside the lagoon during the 40 days of mourning for Yasmini. For the first 10, Dorian hung suspended over the black void of death, drifting from delirium into coma, then rallying again. Tom, Sarah, and Mansur took turns to wait by his bedside. On the 10th morning, Dorian opened his eyes and looked at Mansur. He spoke weakly but clearly. "Is your mother buried? Have you said the prayers?" "She is buried, and I have prayed over her grave for you and for myself." "That is good, my son." Dorian sank away, but within an hour he woke again and asked for food and drink. "You will live," Sarah told him, as she brought a bowl of broth. "You ran it very fine, Dorian Courtney, but now you will live." Relieved of the terrible anxiety over Dorian's condition, Tom let Sarah and the women servants take over his share of the vigil at the bedside, and he and Mansur devoted themselves to other business. Every day Tom ordered Kadem to be brought up from the orlop deck and exercised in the sunlight and open air. He made sure he was well fed, and that the gash in his scalp healed cleanly. He felt no compassion for the prisoner, but he wanted to ensure his survival in good condition. He was an important part of Tom's plans for the future. Tom had ordered the bush pigskin to be salted and hung in the gift's rigging. He questioned Kadem almost every day in fluent Arabic, forcing him to squat in the shadow of the pigskin that flapped over his head, a constant reminder of the fate that awaited him if he refused to answer. "How did you learn that this ship belonged to me and my brother?" he demanded. And Kadem named the merchant in Zanzibar who had given him this information before the life was choked out of him by the garrote. Tom passed the information to Dorian when he was strong enough to sit up unaided. "So our identity is now known by the spies of Zayn al-Din at every anchorage along the coast from Good Hope to Hormuz and the Red Sea." "The Dutch know us also," Dorian agreed. "Kayser promised that every VOC port in the Orient would be close to us. We must change the cut of our jibs." Tom set about altering the appearance of the two ships. One after the other, they warped them to the beach. Tom used the rise and fall of the tide to careen them over. First, they scraped away the heavy infestation of weed and treated the shipworm that had already taken firm hold in the hulls. Some of these loathsome creatures were as thick as a man's thumb and as long as his arm. They could riddle the timbers with holes until the ship was rotten as cheese and might easily break up in rough weather. They tarred the ship's bottom and renewed the copper sheathing where strips had been torn off, allowing the worm to enter. It was the only effective cure. Then Tom changed the masts and rigging. He stepped a mizzen on the gift. This was something he and Dorian had discussed before. The additional mast altered the appearance and performance of the ship completely. When he took her out to sea for her trials, she sailed a full point closer to the wind and logged an additional 2 knots of speed through the water. Tom and Betula were delighted and reported the success gleefully to Dorian, who insisted on being allowed to hobble to the head of the beach to look at her. "In God's name, she is as fresh as a virgin again." "She must have a new name, brother," Tom agreed. "What shall it be?" Dorian barely hesitated. "The Revenge." Tom saw by his expression what he was thinking, and gave him no argument. "That is an illustrious name," he nodded. "Our great-great-grandfather sailed with Sir Richard Grenfell on the old Revenge." They repainted the hull in sky blue, for that was the hue of the paint they had brought with them in abundance, and checkered the gunports in darker blue. It gave the Revenge a saucy air. Then they began work on the Maid of York. She had always shown a flighty inclination to broach to when driven hard before the wind. Tom took this opportunity to add an additional 10 feet to the mainmast and give it 5 degrees more rake. He also lengthened the bowsprit and moved the jibstay and the staysail stay a touch forward. He repositioned the cradles of the water casks in the holds nearer to the stern to alter her trim. This not only changed her profile, but made her more responsive to the helm and corrected her tendency to being down by the head. Tom gave her the contrary colour scheme to the Revenge, a dark blue hull and sky blue gunports. "She was named after you, the Maid of York," Tom reminded Sarah. "Fair is fair. You must rename her now." "Water Sprite," she said immediately, and Tom blinked. "How did you hit on that? 'Tis a quirky name." "And I am a quirky lady," she laughed.
"That you are," he laughed with her. "But just plain Sprite might be better."
"Are you naming her, or am I?" Sarah asked sweetly.
"Let's say rather we are."
Sarah threw up both her hands in capitulation. When the 40 days of mourning for Yasmini had passed, Dorian was sufficiently recovered to walk unaided to the far end of the beach and swim back across the channel. Although he had recovered much of his strength, the loneliness and deep sadness had marked him. Whenever Mansur could find time from his duties, he and Dorian spent it sitting together and talking quietly. Each evening the entire family gathered around the campfire and discussed their plans. Soon it became obvious that none of them wished to make the lagoon their new home. As they were without horses, Tom and Mansur's scouting expeditions on foot did not penetrate far inland, and they encountered none of the tribes that had once inhabited this country. The old villages were burned and deserted.
"There's no trade unless you have someone to trade with," Tom pointed out. "It is a sickly place. Already we have lost one of our people to the fever." Sarah supported him. "I had hoped so much to meet our gym boy here, but in all this time there's been neither sign nor sight of him. He must have moved on further to the north." There were 100 other possible reasons why Jim had disappeared, but she put them out of her mind.
"We will find him there," she said firmly.
"I, for another, cannot remain here," Mansur said. In these last weeks he had taken his place quite naturally at the family councils. "My father and I have a sacred obligation to find the man who ordered the death of my mother. I know who he is. My destiny lies to the north, in the kingdom of Oman." He looked at his father inquiringly. Slowly Dorian nodded agreement. "Yasmini's murder has changed everything. I now share your sacred obligation of vengeance. We will go northwards together."
"So it's settled then," Tom spoke for all of them. "When we reach Nativity Bay, we can decide again."
"When can we sail?" Sarah asked eagerly. "Name a day."
"The ships are almost ready, and so are we. 10 days from now. The day after Good Friday," Tom suggested. "A propitious day." Sarah composed a letter to Jim. It ran to 12 pages of heavy parchment in her elegant, close-written script. She stitched it into a canvas cover and painted the packet with sky-blue ship's paint and sealed the seams with hot tar. She printed his name on it in white paint and block capitals. "James Archibald Courtney, Esquire." Then she carried it up the hill and with her own hand hid it in the recess below the poststone. She built a tall cairn on top to signal to Jim, when he came, that a letter was waiting for him. Mansur hunted far up the valley and killed 5 more Cape buffalo. The women salted, pickled, and dried the meat, then made spiced sausage for the voyage ahead. Mansur supervised the crews as they refilled all the water casks on both ships. When this was done, Tom and the Arab captains were rowed around the ships to check their trim. Though heavily laden, both vessels rode well. They looked wonderfully elegant in their new paint.